Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast, Olivia Siboney. Great to see you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a real pleasure. Liv, I'm going to call you now.
Please do.
Is a somewhat of an entrepreneurial firecracker. My goodness, this woman is an absolute sort of, she's so involved with so many incredible things. I don't quite know where to start, but I'm going to embarrass her slightly by listing all of her great achievements. And then we can swoop down to all your worst catastrophic moments. But she's an award-winning entrepreneur, serial entrepreneur, and she was listed in the top 10 UK women entrepreneurs in 2019 and was a Wise 100 top woman in social business. And she's been described as a trailblazing ethical investment champion. So she's trailblazing and a firecracker. It's like blowing up everywhere. So she actually left a career at Goldman Sachs, to launch her food tech startup, Grub Club, which she subsequently sold in 2017. And then in that same year, launched Seed Tribe, which is a platform focused on connecting impactful businesses that combine profit and purpose with investors and collaborators and the world. And I want to get into that in a moment. But she's got a whole other laundry list of projects, roles, involvements. I mean, I would be here all day listening, but I would suggest you check her out because there's a whole load of them, but including being a global entrepreneur program deal maker at the Department for International Trade, which I thought was a great job title. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So you've got this long list of interesting topics to talk to you about today. But I'm going to pause and sort of broaden it a little bit. And I've noticed that you've spoken about your grandfather being a great inspiration for you. So could you tell me a little bit about him and why that would be?
Absolutely. I'd be honoured to. My grandfather really was. I'm very honoured to be one of his descendants. He really was my greatest inspiration. And actually, when we think of death, actually, I see that there's the body and then there's the legacy that you've left. And to me, he's still very much alive and pumping. So he still lives on. And I suppose what inspires me a lot about him, classic, young, went straight into the Second World War, was very scarred by the Second World War, mainly in the sense of that lack of resources and hunger and just a lot of sort of needless suffering. And that really marked him. And he had trained as a dentist and continued being a dentist during the war and post-war. But he also was really inspired by being self-sufficient and working within the community. And so he spent, every moment of his spare time working on a little piece of land that he bought in Lancashire, which is where my mother grew up, which is where I was born, and really sort of learning to just farm the land in a very, very, what we now call regenerative farming. But at the time, it just felt like the most sort of logical way to do it, which is just be in tune with the land, have diversity in what you're growing, grow it locally, grow it fresh, share the surplus with those around you. And he did that in such a sort of humble and inspiring way as his sort of side project, in a way that really kind of, he loved nature, but not in a sort of hippie kind of way, but more in a way that we cannot live outside of planetary boundaries, and we cannot live outside of our means because something is going to break. And that attitude really, really inspired me in every single way. And the more I look at the way we look at the world now, I don't know if you've read the Donut Economics, for example, but this concept of living within our means is so, so important, and being able to thrive within that. So it's about not having an attitude of scarcity and fear and running out and hoarding. It's around actually feeling or sacrifice or anything. It's actually being able to sort of set our boundaries and then live happily within that and feel really filled within those particular parameters, rather than always feeling like we don't have enough and we need more and more and more and more. And actually, I think, you know, this constant quest for needing more is actually very distracting to the core of who we are as human beings. And I think if we could take a step back and agree, these are the frameworks, these are the boundaries that we operate within, and within that, we can create our sense of purpose and happiness. I think we do a lot better from it. And I think his was on a micro scale in terms of his life, but I see it all the more sort of amplified in how we now look at our situation in the world. And we could look at the future, both environmentally and socially, and feel really afraid and negative and pessimistic. Or we could look at it and think, actually, you know what, this is an opportunity to maybe reframe how we live our lives and actually be content with a lot less and happier to share and, you know, grateful for what we do have.
Yeah, I think the gratitude point you mentioned there is really quite important in the sense that nowadays you sort of take so much for granted, and this sort of more thing and the plentifulness on the shelves. And you mentioned you the grandfather was hungry during the war, so he then got into this farming and producing his own food because there wasn't any food. And in the 21st century, we're so used to, you know, everything that you possibly could imagine or desire, and everything outside that being on tap 24/7. It's like, wow, you know, we just live in this unbelievably blessed moment. And what we're going to do is sort of calibrate that. It's almost a philosophical approach to life about, okay, we don't have to have endlessly chasing stuff. We can perhaps draw those boundaries more closely. I think that's really a healthy way of viewing things. So there's a really fantastic embodiment there of a set of values and purpose that I think was a really interesting story and an interesting frame. But so you already started your career in the city. So you kind of... Perhaps those ideas sort of emerged later. So what happened when you were working at Goldman Sachs? How come you ended up setting up a food tech company?
So if I rewind a tiny bit before Goldman Sachs to sort of explain how I got to Goldman Sachs. Mm. I actually grew up in a very privileged environment in Monte Carlo. And I would say that mainly shaped everything I sort of would contrast my grandfather's existence and my parents both growing up in very, very poor environments with my way of growing up, which was sort of immersed in the world of the sort of rather filthy rich. And that really shaped me in terms of everything I hated around capitalism, the values around the purpose of just making as much money as possible and just looking the way one needs to look. And I really was just so uncomfortable with that entire upbringing that I sort of had this allergic reaction to it and have always sort of really, really felt that was... everything I wanted to do would be the opposite of the surroundings that I grew up in. So I spent the first part of my career actually really sort of working in charities, working in the public sector, just trying to follow my passion. And honestly, mainly just failing. And partly because I'd probably get too emotionally involved in whatever I was doing and then realizing that actually, you know, when you're young, you're maybe a bit too passionate and you end up clashing with others and then you sort of just leave in disgust. So I actually joined Goldman Sachs because I thought, okay, I've changed careers quite a few times. I'm going to go into something that I absolutely know I am not going to be passionate about. And it's just going to be a job. And I'm just going to do this very functional job until I actually really find my purpose of something that I really, really want to do. And I will not leave Goldman Sachs until I know what I want to do. But it just took a little bit longer than expected. So 7 years later, I was still there until something finally clicked and I was able to leave. And in a way, it was, you know, an interesting journey at Goldman Sachs because I would say it was not for me and I was definitely not a cultural fit. And I left, you know, I could not wait to leave and I could not believe that I held so long there. But at the same time, again, I actually find that the negative experiences, and actually this is, you know, so wonderfully what this podcast is about, are really what shape you. And I think the harder moments you go through are the most valuable lessons that you can take that will shape how you frame your life later on. So rather than feel scarred by some of my experiences, I'm really, really grateful. And they were so important to me in shaping what I wanted to do and what I didn't want to do and some of my values. So that's how I came to Goldman Sachs. So that's how I left Goldman Sachs. and then that's, I have to say, I never saw myself as an entrepreneur, but I just had this urge to make the food system better. And I guess I hadn't even thought of my grandfather at the time, but it really did sort of shape a lot of everything that I am and believe in. But I met someone while I was working out in India for Goldman Sachs. He was Indian. He was partly living back in India, partly in the UK. So when we both came back at the same time to the UK, he knew I was desperate to fix the food system and had an idea. And that's how I just left Goldman Sachs and thought, let's just do this.
Amazing. I mean, it's interesting. You've got this little period of where you've flip-flopped. I'm not going to call it flip-flop, but you went from Monte Carlo, the rarefied air of Rolls Royces and money, into the sort of opposite of that, the charities, and you kind of threw yourself into that. And then you went almost to this other extreme, perhaps more towards the Monte Carlo end of Goldman Sachs, which again is a sort of relatively rarefied environment to be in. Whether you feel about that, and then into the kind of startup world. Now just into because you brought it up about the lessons, you've got kind of this sort of, let's call it the yin and yang of you, the sort of charity bit and the Goldman Sachs bit. What was the lesson or the lesson you learned from the charity experience, you feel? And then what was the lesson from the Goldman's experience? You said there's some negative stuff in there, but like, what are the two big lessons from that little moment in your life?
Great questions. So I'd say from the charity perspective, a couple of lessons learned is, I support a lot of charities, but actually working within them, I realized that my experience of where I worked, and the experience of a lot of my friends who do work in charities is often that I found it quite a tough environment to work in. I found it quite vague and not very focused. And there was a lot of sort of time wasted in the organizations that I was part of. And I didn't really feel like I was particularly achieving much. It felt really sort of quite antiquated. So there was an element of just in terms of job satisfaction that I just struggled to get because I didn't really know, we weren't really moving anywhere. And sort of people all also had their slightly different perspectives on how things should be done. And because you had a mixture of people who were really, really passionate, and then they'd all feel really strongly about the direction in which it should go. And then you also had a bunch of people who just were completely uninterested and just quite sort of bureaucratic, and then sort of quite stale. So you had this sort of mixture of perspectives, which kind of clashed. And as a result, I think we struggled to move anywhere. And we didn't necessarily have sort of a particular set of targets or focus to sort of give us direction to work towards. So I didn't feel I was particularly achieving very much. There was another thing, which is what really, really fundamentally shaped what I do now at Seed Tribe, which is quite simply that ultimately, and this took me a really long time to get to because of my scarring of my upbringing, that for a long time, I was just really anti-capitalist. Money was a really dirty thing. It was just all about peace and love and harmony. And then you kind of realize that money is kind of what powers everything else. It's just quite simply that for me, money is not the goal. Money is the enabler towards something else. But I took a really long time to get to that. So coming back to the charity world, essentially, they still need to make money because they need to pay their staff. They need to be able to pay their offices and all of their expenses. So in one way or another, they still need to bring some money in order to achieve the purpose that they're looking to achieve. But what you have is a completely separate department of people who are essentially begging for money in different ways. And that begging of money can either be through corporate funders, through, you know, individual donors, through grants. And when you're looking, you know, ideally you want a corporate funder or a grant maker because that's just going to be a larger pot of money. At the same time, that comes with its own restrictions. So you have a 2-year lit pot of money, and within that, you have to achieve these particular goals. So you're going to slightly shift the purpose of your charity in order to fit within that bucket in order to get that money. Then you can only look 2 years ahead, and then you can't plan for the longer term. So in a way, you're actually really not doing your purpose, you're not enabling yourself as a charity to achieve your greatest purpose because you can't think long term. You keep having to sort of switch according to your funders' needs, and it just slows down a lot of your mission. And I would say, therefore, the greatest lesson for me there was really that actually, you know, money is really important, and it is the international currency. And so actually, if we can embed the financial element into the purpose that we are driving, we then can hope to achieve much greater impact with what we're doing.
Yeah, it's a very good shout. And I think it's something that's like reconciling those two things, the profit, which can often be seen as a dirty word, and the purpose, because I totally agree, money enables you to deliver the mission. And so when you went into Goldman's, and what was the kind of big life lesson through that experience? What were the scars that you got that you've learned from?
I fell into it because I was looking for a temporary job, and I got an interview there as a temp, and then it just became permanent. And then I didn't expect to sort of be promoted within the ranks. So there was no design in specifically applying to Goldman Sachs beyond what the recruitment agency at the time put me forward for. And so I hadn't really sort of thought through what I was letting myself into. And as you pointed out earlier, the irony of me going to Goldman Sachs of all places when I was trying to run away from Monaco was not lost on me either, or any of my friends who was really vocal about these things. So what I would say there is I was actually really lucky. I had a wonderful team. Actually, the department I worked in was great. So the people I was immediately surrounded with were amazing people. And that's probably what meant that I sort of stayed there a lot longer than I could have done. At the same time, when you are quite junior, you can just keep your head focused down on your individual tasks and your immediate team members. And in a way, that was fine. I love being challenged. It was really interesting. I was learning a lot along the way. The more I sort of rose through the ranks, the more, of course, I was exposed to the greater purpose of the organization. And the more that happened, the more I realized how much at odds I was with the beliefs and the purpose of the organization and its way of working and its impact on the greater world. And I think I sort of was trying to also stick to, for better or for worse, I don't know if that was a good or bad thing, but sort of to remind myself that I just shouldn't just jump ship again and for the first thing that comes, and sort of thinking I just need to stick with this until I find something that I really, really, really want to do. So I was trying to sort of ignore those ethical issues I had around what impact the organization had on the wider world. And honestly, the more it went, the more that clashed with everything I did. And I started becoming much less good at performing because I just was not engaged with the greater purpose. And the more it went, the worse it got, to a point where I just didn't realize the body signals of imminent depression and anxiety, until the point where I literally was completely overwhelmed by it. And I just arrived at work one day and was incapable of actually reading anything on my screen. Everything was just a complete blur. Suddenly I couldn't breathe. And it just felt so, so overwhelming. And I think it really was just, you know, years of buildup of moving further and further away from everything that were my fundamental beliefs and values that really hit home. And one of the lessons learned there is to actually, you know, from that, I got a lot of therapy and then started doing meditation. And the lesson learned there is to actually just listen to yourself earlier so that you can detect the signs and just address some of the challenges early doors rather than letting it build up and explode.
That's really interesting. And what's interesting is the word dis-ease is dis-ease. And what you're describing there was a sort of a misalignment of your values and beliefs with what you, how you're acting in the real world. And then that became unsustainable, I guess. And then you had the, you kind of burnout type of thing, as you describe it. And I can see that because, again, that's something that's quite interesting when, you, when we talk about values and belief and purpose. And it sounds, can sound a little bit intellectual and kind of airy-fairy or kind of, well, what is that really? But actually, if you're not living these things, it can make you sick, as you have described.
Yeah, yeah, spot on, exactly. And for me, it's really important to, I think I was just born with this sense of just wanting to contribute to the world and leave more than I take. And that felt I was doing the exact opposite in that world. So for me, that sat really, really uncomfortably.
And what I get from, or the impression from how you're acting in the world now is it's very much quite clear that that has to be aligned. There's a sort of integrity in terms of the oneness of it, not a duality, an integrity. But just again, sort of reading up on you and your experience around God Club, it seemed to be that that surfaced again in terms of one of the reasons you left that that company, is there was a kind of misalignment between perhaps where you wanted to go and where you were being perhaps forced to go because of circumstance or the investors. Could you just speak a little bit on that? It's almost like it's sort of like a crisis of the soul almost that got you to kind of split from that business. Could you just take us through what happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I was trying before our conversation to think through what some of the, in my long list of failures, which ones I could highlight more.
Best ones.
Yeah, a very Chinese length menu. And it was actually exactly that. I think it was, so I was really quite desperate to leave the world I was in. In fact, at this point, I had no choice because I was in the middle of depression and on sick leave and realizing that something needed to change. So when my friend approached me and he said to me, look, you've always wanted to change the world through food. You've got all of these sort of random business plans that you're writing and you don't seem to be sort of, you know, engaged with any of them because I had all these brilliant ideas, but none of them had a proper business model to them. So I didn't want to sort of go ahead with him. And he came up with this concept of social dining. And I was a little bit naive, but again, I'm so grateful for my experience. But in retrospect, that was the sort of biggest lesson learned, which is that I was a little bit naive in thinking, okay, social dining, we'll bring people around a table together to meet and share a meal. That's a really good starting point for helping people to appreciate the value of food. And from there, then we can start getting the chefs to talk about the origin of where the food comes from. And that means we're going to engage people in understanding that they need to be more involved in understanding, you know, the traceability of food and why it's important to buy good quality food and enjoy it, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, that was just so far removed from the actual business model of what we were doing. So very naively, really, when it boils down to the real essence of what we were doing, we essentially, our business model was, we do really wonderful dinners in really wonderful spaces with really wonderful chefs for lovely middle-class people to have a really lovely time. That is our business model. And actually, all of the extras are on top. And yes, it would be really wonderful for them to be able to tell us, you know, for the chefs to tell the story of what they're doing and where the food comes from and get consumers to change how they consume food, as it were, and their relationship with them. Wonderful. But that is not your business model. And of course, when you're in the startup mode and you're just scrabbling around to just make it work, especially when it's your first startup and you come from the likes of Goldman Sachs, which is a massive organization with all of the systems and processes in place, you're having to kind of destroy your entire formative years of how you work within a business sense and be, you know, embracing risk and really quick and et cetera, and not process driven. And so actually, ultimately, you're just struggling for survival. And all you're trying to do is just trying to get to the next day, to the next day, to the next investment process stage and the next one and the next one and the next one. And all the investors care about is your hockey stick growth curve and how you're going to get to that. And you really just need to focus on how am I making money and how can I increase that? And so it kept coming back to just going, how are we going to increase ticket sales? How are we going to increase our margins? How are we going to streamline our processes within that? And there just was not time to be able to embed all of the things that I really believed in. And that was such an important lesson, which was, you know, everyone was having a great time, but I was just sat thinking, I'm just doing really lovely middle-class dinners, and wonderful as it is, this is not the purpose that I am trying to achieve. So my greatest lesson there by far was just, you have to be really core and sort of really focused in thinking, what is my purpose? What am I actually trying to achieve with my business? And how am I going to make money through that exact specific purpose, not a peripheral nice to have around it?
That's interesting. And it's this surfacing of the sort of unease or the dis-ease that you felt at that point. Yeah. It's almost your intuition, your sort of conscience, your soul kind of going, hey, yeah, this isn't working. And so this is interesting because you then acted on that. Yeah. So you've had this sort of period where you're in the charities at Goldman Sachs, the misalignment made you ill, then you're then in this kind of the startup thing, which is very hard, and I recognize everything you're saying, but then you could have just been drawn into the vortex. So what happened when you actually made the decision to leave and to sort of stand by your beliefs and your values?
So I think we got to a point with my business partner where we actually also just realized our values and goals were misaligned. But ultimately, so we sort of realized that we were probably not going to make it work together. And then we had sort of we were at least able to be very open with each other. And we had a long discussion, and ultimately, you know, both of us were in a sort of, you know, struggling with our own relationships with the business. And in a way, we sort of looked at it and we sort of debated, you know, maybe which one of us would take it forward. And actually, I had to be honest with myself, which is that when I looked at the business we were running, if I were to take it over and look at how we better embed my purpose into it, it just didn't make sense in any way, as the whole business model, everything we'd created had just moved further and further and further away from what I really believed in. So I really honestly just looked at it and thought, I'm not quite sure I can turn this around to do what I would love it to do. And at the same time, we realized that there were, you know, competitors around the world who, you know, in the US in particular, but actually across Europe as well, who were doing well around the world and kept struggling in the UK and were keen to buy the company. So this just felt like a really, really good time that actually we would, discuss it with the different buyers and, you know, sell it to the biggest bidder. And then my business partner would then sort of carry on for the next couple of years to kind of do the transition. So it just came from that sense that I struggled with imagination on thinking what I could do with it, didn't necessarily also want to do it alone. And there were buyers for the company, and it just felt like serendipitous timing that this is, and it, you know, still exists and thrives, survived the pandemic. So I'm really happy to see it still going strong. But it does what we had built it to be rather than what my heart had originally wanted it to be.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, and so how did you? That's a quite a fraught situation, though. And I guess you say it's serendipitous. How did you tippy toe your way through that? And, you know, not your head didn't blow up, or maybe it did blow up. I mean, it's funny when you. So I've had situations with exiting companies, and the headlines like "Man Leaves Company," but the experience itself is always. Well, I found it quite emotionally difficult. How did you find that experience?
Do you know? I think again when we talk about lessons learned, departure from Goldman Sachs felt really dramatic and kind of unexpected. I thought I was okay until I physically could neither see nor breathe. And I was so shocked by this lack of understanding of my limits and who I am and how I function. that I really took from that, that I should approach life in a different way. So firstly, I sort of learned through that to be a bit more careful about listening to myself and recalibrating and just talking more openly along the way. So I think that helped. And the other thing is, when I left Goldman Sachs and when I started my business, I'd never seen myself as an entrepreneur, and I'd read the stats of 9 in 10 businesses failing. So I thought, okay, well, I'm not a natural entrepreneur and I'm statistically extremely likely to fail. Therefore, rather than going into this sort of with high hopes, I'm going to go into this as a big learning journey. And everything I'm going to do is just going to be incredible learning experience. So, of course, sometimes you lose sight of that. But along the way, I was always trying really hard. Every single failure, which were, of course, many, you would just go through every one of them going, oh, well, I'm really grateful I've learned that now rather than later on. And let me just try and switch things along the way. So in a way, I sort of really tried very hard to kind of have that attitude all the way through, which meant that by the end of it, yes, I mean, tension had built up. And it had been more stressful than expected. But at the same time, I did sort of just think, actually, this is all just the most amazing set of lessons I could have ever learned. And I'm so grateful for my lessons. And I'm just sorry to my investors that I lost some of their money in the transition. But actually, they were all extremely supportive and, you know, got obviously, you know, a bunch of their money back. And ultimately, it was fine. But funny enough, it was an interesting story because the company that bought us out was really good at creating a story that was around full success. As we were talking earlier, sometimes the, you know, headlines do hide the vulnerabilities and the story behind it. So the headline made it sound amazing. And, you know, I was gone by then, so
Who are you to disagree? Exactly. You know, it's funny, and I think just specifically on this, I think this is really important, particularly in the perhaps world. I want to go on to Seed Tribe now, because the world of startups and tech startups and investment is just categorized by like press releases in TechCrunch saying everything's amazing. And I think there's a really important thing here is that entrepreneurs can kind of look at that and take it at face value. But every headline has got these kind of emotional, these vulnerable, this kind of fear and terror and things going wrong that are behind all that. And it's just all like lots of kind of makeup being applied to that to make it look good. And I think that's something that's... I get a lot of this feedback, by the way, just with the podcast, people saying it's so healthy to hear people not just be saying the kind of press release stuff. Anywho, so Seed Tribe, you kind of moved out and you set up this outfit. And can you just talk us through what it is and why it exists and what's its purpose?
Yeah, I will. And I might even sort of make it fast forward and in order to talk about like this specific point that you're talking about. So to sort of quickly rewind, I guess probably it's come across by now that purpose for me is really important and it needs to be embedded into the business model. So that literally is what shaped my view of how to form Seed Tribe, which was that I'm going to help it. And I was really scarred by the investment process. I really hated having to pitch for money constantly, which is unpleasant and really distracting from your business. So I thought, can I make this any better for other entrepreneurs? So from my lessons, I realized that I wanted to support businesses that marry purpose and profit. And I'm extremely strict about that. So anyone who comes to me saying, I'm looking for investment and, you know, I give one t-shirt free for every t-shirt I've sold, not good enough. Because ultimately, when push comes to shove and you need to survive in your business and you need to cut costs, of course, that free t-shirt is going to go. So the actual business model needs to address a social or environmental challenge. And to give you examples to sort of make this more real, it's, you know, from an environmental perspective, it could be we have machines that turn dirty water into clean water, or the circular economy is a perfect example where there's so much waste that can be turned into either energy or another resource. It could be an energy saving device. It could be something around, you know, clean homes, etc. On the social side, tends to be sort of a lot of healthcare related stuff. So we've got, you know, tools that can detect the early signs of cancer, or a lot around mental health, or around even employee well-being or financial inclusion, et cetera, education. So those are the kinds of themes broadly to give you an idea of what I'm looking at when you marry profit and purpose. So my purpose was really, how can I help more of these companies to grow so that they can achieve a positive social and environmental impact on the world? And how can I make this investment process a little bit less painful for them so that they can get back to achieving their purpose? Now, just on that, I'm sort of with that evolution, you know, I sit very firmly within the angel investment world. That is what I do. But interestingly, where I've got to with that is, you know, from a systemic and a cultural perspective, we are all only looking at success being hockey stick growth curve. Who is going to be the next unicorn? From a systemic perspective, you know, in the UK, we have SEIS and EIS, these incredible tax incentive schemes. But the challenge is that, you know, they really incentivize boom or bust. You're only going to get your tax break as an investor if the company goes bust, or if they have a really good exit. There's not, you get penalized for nice, healthy, steady growth with nice profits along the way. You are literally not allowed to do that. And so that's the systemic challenge, is that we only have a culture encouraging boom or bust. From a cultural perspective, it's just, you know, we all look to Silicon Valley and success means unicorn, because of course unicorns really exist, don't they? So everything is pointing towards that. And I actually feel quite uncomfortable about that, because I understand how that is for some people, and great if that's what they want to do. But I just feel that we're really missing the trick on having a broader set of options for people to grow businesses that are actually going to deliver genuine value to the world in the deeper sense of meaning of value. And so what I'm actually working on right now is looking to build a variety of different collaborations things I'm working on myself, is how can we offer a set of options of ways that impactful startups can scale so that they are not only dependent on the angel investment and then venture capital, which is an exacerbation of the angel status to grow their business. And that can be through different forms of collaboration. So can we have government incentives that reward both the entrepreneur and the investor for the impact that they're having on the world? If we can reduce queues at the waiting time at the NHS, if we can catch cancer in the early stages, if we can improve literacy rates across the board in schools and access to education, if we can improve efficiency of energy in homes, why would an entrepreneur and an investor not be rewarding for delivering that kind of value, which, you know, from a finance, if you bring it all down to a financial perspective, all of this costs the government money. So why not embed that into the incentivization scheme for entrepreneurs? So that's one perspective, but I'm also working on sort of connecting them more closely with corporates in a sort of co-learning way, that they can learn to sort of partner in ways that are mutually beneficial. So I think there's also sort of other forms of debt or ways that you can gain equity with sort of foundations or other organizations that actually are better linked to purpose. So I'm very much working on finding ways that we can help entrepreneurs to scale, and that it is okay to not want to be a unicorn if you don't want to be a unicorn, but still to feel that you can have another way of looking at what success means in the world.
Yeah, it's very true. There's a lot of one of the myths of entrepreneurship, and there's many, is that this sort of I'm going to be the next Elon Musk kind of thing, where unless you've got three or four companies that are worth billions and you're going to Mars, then you're kind of a loser.
Yeah.
You know? And that's fair. That, again, I just in my observation, my company's self-financed and bootstrapped and has been for 17 years. We've never taken investment. And the point being is, I don't really know that world really, but from observing it from the outside in, it seems to be the structure, like you say, the system is geared up for the kind of venture capital view of the world, where they can lose 90% of the money, because that's the way it works, but 10% are unicorns, quotes, and then they make their money back 1,000x. But the problem with that is the sort of spaghetti that you're hurling at the wall are kind of human beings and potential that could impact the world. And so if you're all you're just doing is churning this kind of money-making sausage machine, and in the middle of it, my take is I'm very focused on things like burnout and entrepreneur sort of mental health. And that's kind of like, well, in the middle of that are a whole bunch of people grinding themselves to death to sort of serve this higher system. And I think that's wrong, personally. And I think so this idea of exploring ways of encouraging focus on the outcome and the value of that through the purpose, I think is sort of fantastic.
Yeah, I think for me, it's really important, and it's spot on. We just, you know, ultimately, we need to live within our means in every single way. And that means not burning out. And I think we should find ways to, and there are, it's not like they need to be discovered. There are many ways in which we can work collaboratively, in ways that are mutually beneficial, in ways that doesn't mean that success means you have to take everyone down along the way to be at the top. I think success can be shared.
I agree. I totally. I mean, it's this idea of instead of a negative sum mindset where I win, you lose, it's a positive sum mindset where to combine together, we can create something that's 10x or multiple x, me and you. And that kind of idea is very much what I've approached my life just through that. And it definitely is what works. And that's funny, you talk about capitalism and you started your life sort of being anti this sort of entity. And there's a lot of that around on out there now, people being disenchanted with the system. And the way I see it is, well, yeah, there's a lot to be disenchanted with, for sure. But you can evolve that system. And there are ethics, to go back to that word, like collaboration, a positive sum mindset, a win-win mindset, where we can actually create impact through creation of profit. That, for me, feels like a kind of very actionable thing you could do today, rather than a kind of let's just junk it all and start again kind of mindset. And so for me, that's very much what I'm trying to do in my own small way. And that spirit and ethic, I feel, is definitely one that we should encourage. So I think what you're doing is great.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that, because that would be the one biggest takeaway I wish everyone could have, which is exactly the sense that we can be, you know, if you look at the bigger picture, whether it's capitalism or, you know, also whatever, our financial systems or climate change or society, it feels so big and overwhelming that you feel completely powerless to anything and probably quite negative and pessimistic. Actually, for me, if you bring it down to, and that's why entrepreneurship, but actually even just citizenship, is a really important way to realize that actually, let's say climate change, I hate the concept, the word climate change. Actually, what that is a series of individual reasons for which the climate is changing. So if you break it down into looking at, you know, the seas and our riverbeds and pollution levels and waste, then actually you suddenly realize that it's lots and lots of individual things. You could just focus on one of them and you look to achieve that. And you are contributing towards climate change. You are taking action. But, you know, the analogy of eating the elephant, just start with the toe and that is how you're going to get there, rather than feeling overwhelmed. So all of us have an ability, and actually I would even say with the current climate, a duty to have a positive impact on the world. And it is not as difficult as we think. We just need to start small with where we feel we can affect that change. And I think entrepreneurship is a really wonderful way to go about that.
No, I agree. There's a ripple effect that you have the potential to create as an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And again, that's part of what I'm hoping to achieve in this podcast, for what it's worth, is to help the entrepreneur themselves to be kind of, you know, we're part of a tribe here that are muddling our way through, trying to do create impact. And so we can help that entrepreneur, then that ripple effect has the potential to sustain. And that's what's driving me here for sure. Beautiful. I mean, it's been such a fantastic conversation. If people wanted to connect with you online or learn more about what you're up to, where should we send them?
So you can either come to Seed Tribe, seedtribe.com, seed like one that you plant, tribe like lots of people, or LinkedIn. I'm quite active on LinkedIn as well. So Olivia Sibini, I guess it'll show on the title of the podcast. You literally, I think I'm the only one. So you can find me on LinkedIn as well.
She's the only one, the unique one-off, one of a kind on LinkedIn. We'll put the links in the show notes, and please do check out, I mentioned this at the start, you're involved in so many great things, and so please everyone check it out, because it's stuff that you may be inspired by or be interested in joining be part of, or perhaps you can contribute to in some way. Yes. It's been such a fantastic conversation, so thank you for being so generous with your time and being so open. I for one have learned a lot, and it's got my me thinking, so great to see you, great to have you on the podcast, and hopefully see you soon.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks everyone for joining us, and I'll see you next time. Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluupthebusiness.com. And just enter your email address. There's a little box. Just enter it in and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us. Help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company... give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.